This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Pafizkar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى مقومًا ولا أذلهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Australia's top general admits there was credible evidence his country's forces unlawfully killed at least 39 civilians and inmates in Afghanistan between 2005 and 2016. A US federal judge blocks the Trump administration's policy of expelling migrant children caught crossing into the United States. Also ahead, Storm Iota leaves more than 30 people dead after it unleashed the devastating floods across Central America. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the reigning capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Australia's defence chief has apologised to Afghanistan after admitting that there was credible evidence his country's forces unlawfully killed at least 39 Afghan civilians and prisoners.
None of the alleged unlawful killings were described as being in the heat of battle. None were alleged to have occurred in circumstances in which the intent of the perpetrator was unclear, confused, or mistaken. And every person spoken to by the inquiry thoroughly understood the law of armed conflict and the rules of engagement under which they operated. These findings allege the most serious breaches of military conduct and professional values.
General Campbell was detailing the findings of an inquiry into suspected war crimes by Australian Special Forces personnel between 2005 and 2016. The report found that Afghan prisoners were ordered killed by junior soldiers to, quote, blood them. It also revealed that soldiers then placed weapons next to the bodies of the deceased to give the impression that they posed a military threat. The report also outlined that there was competition between some patrols to outscore others in the number of enemy soldiers killed in action. Australian troops were deployed to Afghanistan in 2002 as part of the US-led coalition to fight the Taliban militants. Political commentator Tim Anderson says a recent report on Australia's potential war crimes in Afghanistan proves that the occupying forces in that country need to withdraw immediately.
The investigation stretched back 14 years. It covered about seven years. So these are systematic, deep-seated crimes covering many people. In the report, 25 people involved in 39 separate killings. When it comes to the Statute of Rome, countries have to exhaust their local avenues first. But if the government of Afghanistan decided to put it to the International Criminal Court, I think that would be a better way of dealing with it, because in many respects we have had a culture of cover-up in this country and in internal investigations there. This report has been remarkably frank, but there have been cover-ups in the past, and so an independent body would have more credibility. It's certainly staining the reputation of Australian forces, and of course remember they are trained and equipped, their technology links into the US forces in the areas in which they're involved, which have nothing to do with the defence of Australia. So the question of their role there certainly should be in question. I'll be one of the people raising that. Remember, the outgoing president, apparently outgoing president in the US, is already talking about withdrawing some of the troops there. I think these sort of crimes or public notice of these sorts of crimes should be a lever by which the occupying forces in Afghanistan should be forced to leave. They've never done anything good in that country.
Elsewhere, a federal judge has ordered the U.S. administration to stop expelling immigrants' children who crossed the southern border alone. The ruling by the U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan came as part of a preliminary injunction sought by legal groups. He argued the minors were likely to suffer irreparable harm if summarily returned to their home countries. However, the order does not prohibit officials from continuing to expel adults or families with children. Immigration curbs have been a key part of President Donald Trump's policy. Citing the coronavirus pandemic, his administration has expelled nearly 200,000 migrants caught crossing the U.S.-Mexico border from March through the end of September. The figure includes around 9,000 unaccompanied children. The Supreme Court of the U.S. state of Pennsylvania says it will take up an appeal by the president's campaign challenging thousands of mail-in votes with missing information on their envelopes. The number of votes to be challenged are unclear, but the decision by the Supreme Court will likely impact ballots across the state. On Friday, the lower court of common pleas ruled against Donald Trump's campaign, which sought to invalidate more than 8,000 votes in Philadelphia. The Trump campaign has been filing several lawsuits trying to overturn election outcome in Pennsylvania and several other states. Trump claims his Democratic rival Joe Biden won the November 3rd election because it was rigged. The president's refusal to concede has sparked simmering tensions between his supporters and opponents. A new poll shows the United States is almost evenly split regarding the integrity of their recent presidential vote. Many say a thorough judicial review of the vote may be the only way to prevent massive political alienation, but even that would be highly polarizing as well. Rami Mazahari has more from Chicago.
A 227-page poll from The Economist magazine reveals a massive lack of faith in the recent U.S. presidential vote. When asked, how much voter fraud do you think occurred in this election, 40% of Americans answered enough to influence the outcome. 42% said that mail ballots are being manipulated to favor Joe Biden. When asked, do you think Donald Trump should contest the results of the election in court, 46% said yes. That number includes 9 out of 10 Republicans, 53% of independents, and even 10% of Democrats. 45% of respondents believe that Biden did not legitimately win the election.
I am part of that 45%, if that's the accurate number. Anyone in government right now should be pushing for litigation. Absolutely. Everyone in government should be like, we are here to serve the people. We are here for the people's interest. This is priority issue number one. And anyone who is not, you know, in following in that kind of regard, in my mind, why are you in government? What agenda do you have other than the people?
These staggering findings seem to portend long-term political alienation among nearly half the country. However, the poll also shows that half the country views the election as legitimate. They often accuse the other side of being sore losers, of misinterpreting data, and of creating divisions during a terribly tumultuous year.
I don't see election fraud. I think that it's just a president who's upset that he lost and a party that, you know, is slowly diminishing and losing their, you know, their power in Washington. So for me, and I think the most of the American people, you know, we saw it as a legitimate election.
U.S. had a deeply disputed election in the year 2000, which only ended when the Supreme Court told Florida to stop their recount. It later surfaced that 14% of African-American ballots were questionably thrown out. An intensely polarized nation still has two self-declared presidents. And the tension and cultural fallout from the narrow, disputed, and still being counted November 3rd vote seems to be mounting daily. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Now, the number of coronavirus fatalities in the United States has surpassed a quarter of a million. The Johns Hopkins University data also show the number of infections nearing 11.5 million. The number of hospitalizations is at a record high of nearly 77,000. This is while the projected winner of the November 3rd presidential vote says the agency that keeps the U.S. federal bureaucracy running is the biggest impediment to new efforts to fight the coronavirus outbreak. Joe Biden said a lot of things, including the distribution plan for COVID-19 vaccines, were not available to his team. The United States is the world's worst hit country by the pandemic. Another hard hit country in the Americas region is Brazil, with more than 5.9 million infections and over 167,000 deaths. U.S. stocks have declined, reversing early gains amid investors' concerns over mounting COVID-19 cases that have forced more parts of the U.S. to impose restrictions. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 both fell over 1% in the closing session. The Nasdaq Composite also dropped 0.8%. The stocks opened in green after the American drug maker Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech disclosed positive final analysis data from a trial of their coronavirus vaccine. But they suffered losses in the last 2 hours of trading after New York City announced it was closing schools for in-person instruction due to rising coronavirus cases. Investors are wary of the return of fresh social distancing measures in some states, which could threaten a slight economic rebound. The Japanese Prime Minister says his country is on maximum alert after reporting a record number of daily coronavirus infections. Yoshihide Suda urged the caution, calling on people to wear face masks. However, the government says it will not immediately declare a health emergency. Japan reported an all-time high of more than 2,000 new cases on Wednesday, with nearly 500 in the capital, Tokyo, alone. Meanwhile, South Korea kicked off a special two-week coronavirus prevention period that, after daily cases there, topped 300 on Wednesday for the first time since August. One of Australia's strictest lockdowns also kicked off in the country's south amid the surging pandemic there. Outdoor gatherings, weddings, and funerals are all forbidden in the state of South Australia under the six-day lockdown. Schools, universities, cafes, and food courts have also closed. More than 30 people have lost their lives after Storm Iota unleashed heavy rains, causing floods and mudslides across Central America. Nicaragua has suffered the highest toll, with 18 confirmed deaths after the storm pummeled the country on Monday. In neighboring Honduras, 14 people, including 5 members of a family, died in a landslide. Over 70,000 Hondurans were also forced to flee their homes. Floods have inundated a large number of villages as several rivers burst their banks in the two countries. In Panama, about 2,000 people stayed at shelters. Iota dissolved into a tropical storm after reaching El Salvador, where hundreds of people were also evacuated. The U.S.-based Hurricane Center has warned that the storm's remnants could trigger more life-threatening flooding and landslide. Several U.S. senators have announced they would introduce pieces of legislation seeking to reject Donald Trump's administration's efforts to sell weapons to the United Arab Emirates. One Republican and two Democratic senators said 4 separate pieces of legislation would be introduced. The move seeks to reject the White House's effort to sell more than $23 billion of drones and other weapons systems to the Arab country. Earlier, the members of the Foreign Affairs Committees of the Senate and House had criticized the UAE's role in civilian deaths in the war on Yemen. The drone sale follows the U.S. F-35 fighter jet deal with the country. Iran says it needs more time to clarify questions raised by the International Atomic Energy Agency about its safeguards declarations. The agency says it needs Tehran's full and prompt clarification concerning uranium particles at an undisclosed location. Hermelezgi reports.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's Director General addresses the agency's Board of Governors. Rafael Mariano Grossi says the presence of uranium particles at an undeclared location in Iran still needs to be fully and promptly clarified by Tehran.
We believe that they need to give us information which is credible. What they are telling us from a technical point of view doesn't add up. So they need to clarify this.
Iran's ambassador to the agency says while it took the IAEA 8 months to analyze samples, Iran has only had 2.5 months to work on the latest findings of the agency and provide clarifications.
We have worked substantively on this issue. These are not political issues. These are purely legal and technical issues. It's very natural that the two sides to have different views on the technical matters like this issue, the samples and the analysis, and the results of the analysis. We are working with the agency in this regard with a view to the finalization of the resolution of this issue.
Grossi also reported that Iran has begun feeding uranium gas into a cascade of more advanced centrifuges at its underground enrichment plant at Natanz. The move is part of measures undertaken by Iran beyond the limitations set in the nuclear deal following the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. Grossi says the operation of these more advanced centrifuges will not lead to a significant increase in the volume of Iran's enriched uranium, currently 12 times the limit mentioned in the nuclear deal. Iran says it's ready to reverse all the steps it has taken beyond its commitments so far if sanctions are lifted and the European signatories to the deal remain committed to their obligation to cooperate in the economic and nuclear fields with Tehran. Homolezki, Vienna.
And in other news, Palestinians have staged a rally against the planned visit of the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to an illegal Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank. Mona Kandil has more in this report.
Hundreds of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank city of Albiri have demonstrated in front of the illegal Israeli settlement of Pesigot to protest the planned visit of U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Pompeo's tour marks the first time that a top American diplomat has visited an Israeli settlement. Owners of the land where Pesigot settlement has been established say the policy of the American administration will continue to support the occupation.
We are not surprised because this is what we expected from this government. Okay, United States government is taking a position historically against the Palestinian rights and in support of the Israelis' settlement. We know that unless there is so much pressure on the Israeli from the United States itself, it will never be solved on this land.
Pompeo's visit comes 2 months before the inauguration of the U.S. next administration. Observers here say Israel is seeking to impose more restrictions in the West Bank with the help of Trump's administration. The Palestinian leadership has denounced Pompeo's visit as a way to legalize the settlements. Palestinians say the visit at this time specifically sets a dangerous precedent that violates international law.
The visit of the U.S. Secretary of State comes along with the crimes that the Trump administration has committed against the Palestinians. Trump wants to legalize the settlements. All settlements are illegal under international law and amount to war crimes. We will do whatever in our power to stop Israel's annexation plan.
Anti-settlement groups revealed that during Trump's term in office, Israel has approved thousands of new settlement units, including in highly contested areas, and 2020 marked one of the most prolific years for Israel's illegal settlement construction. Trump has given unprecedented support to Israel by recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. The administration has also recognized Israel's annexation of the occupied Golan Heights, seized from Syria in the 1967 war, where Pompeo may also pay a visit. Trump's so-called Middle East plan allows Israel to annex nearly one-third of the West Bank, including all of its settlements. Mike Pompeo's visit to the region is seen as a gift to Tel Aviv from the Trump administration that took unprecedented steps to support Israel's attempts to annex the occupied West Bank. Palestinians say the visit to a settlement shows Washington's rudeness in approving settlements that are internationally seen as illegal. Mona Kandil, in front of the Israeli settlement of Pesigot, occupied Albire.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Limelight. More than 1,000 nuclear bomb tests have been conducted in the United States between 1945 and 1992. A total of 100 above-ground nuclear tests were conducted at the Nevada test site from 1951 to 1962. The winds carried radioactive fallout from thousands for thousands of kilometers. Hundreds of millions of people living in the United States have been exposed to varying levels of radiation over the years, unknown to them. New Mexico was downwind of the Nevada test site, and the people living there continued to be exposed to radioactivity for decades after the initial exposure during the Trinity nuclear test. People from the impacted communities founded the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium in 2005 to fight for justice for the survivors and their descendants. Tina Cordova, one of the group's co-founders, was shocked to find out that a few of the impacted states neighboring New Mexico were receiving financial compensation under the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act since 1990. However, the communities in New Mexico were left out of the act. When asked why, Cordova responds with, "It is the billion-dollar question. I think we're being left out because we're mainly Mexican Hispanics, natives and Latinos. We are minorities and we are poor." We have prepared for you an article written by Satya Bharti, a journalist with Breakthrough News, an independent media platform in the United States, highlighting the untold stories of the resistance of poor and working class communities. The piece is titled 75 Years Later, Victims of Nuclear Bomb Tests on U.S. Soil Still Seek Justice. Please stay with us for more of Satya Bharti's article. Genoveva Peralta Purcella explains they thought the world was coming to an end. On 16th of July 1945, the first ever nuclear bomb was tested in New Mexico, in the southwestern United States. The detonation was codenamed Trinity. It is the day that would seal the fate of many Americans living in the surrounding areas for generations to come. 70 miles from what became known as Ground Zero, the Trinity test site, Genoveva's family lived on a ranch just outside the village of Capitan in New Mexico. Genoveva was born the year after the blast. Now 74 years old, she solemnly recalls how her family remembers the day that would change their lives forever. Genoveva Peralta Porcella's sister had come to visit their father and pregnant mother at the ranch. At precisely 5:30 a.m. local time, as dawn broke, the sky suddenly went pitch dark. Having no other point of reference, they mistook the abnormally loud roaring and rumbling in the sky for thunder. The entire house began to shake. Fear-stricken, the family huddled together in a corner. When the sky cleared, her father stepped outside the house and found himself being showered with a white powder. The powder was everywhere and covered everything around them. Nothing escaped it, not the cows the family had raised, or the vegetables in the garden, or the rainwater they stored in the absence of running water. Like other families who went through this experience, Genoveva's family also dusted off the powder and consumed their vegetables and the stored water. The blast produced so much energy that it incinerated everything it touched and formed a fireball that rose to more than 12 kilometers into the atmosphere. The fireball created ash that snowed over the communities surrounding the blast site. The people did not know it then, but this ash that covered thousands of square miles was the radioactive fallout from the explosion. Dread gripped the communities in Tularosa Basin who either witnessed or experienced the phenomena they could not make sense of. Meanwhile, the immediate reaction of the staff of the Manhattan Project, which created the bomb, was of surprise, joy, and relief. Paul Pino, Genoveva's cousin, who was born 9 years after the Trinity blast, says that his family, which lived 33 miles from the blast site, was one of the many who were unaware of what had transpired on that day. In the days and months leading up to the blast, U.S. government officials did not notify anyone who lived in the region about the imminent nuclear bomb test. Nobody in the Tularosa Basin was evacuated to safety. In the aftermath of the nuclear test, officials began to cement a false narrative into the consciousness of the nation. The region was remote and uninhabited. In fact, tens of thousands of people lived in the Tularosa Basin in 1945. For a long time, the people of the basin believed that the blast was an ammunition explosion. Pino said, "We were lied to by the government." It takes 24,000 years for half of the radioactive plutonium used in the Trinity bomb to decay. The people of the region have inhaled and ingested radioactive particles for 75 years because of environmental contamination. Those in power refuse to accept responsibility and take any corrective action. To this day, there have been no cleanup efforts. Radiation exposure has caused high rates of aggressive cancers, thyroid disease, infant mortality, and other health abnormalities in generations of families in the Tularosa Basin region. The scale of the health impact cannot be determined accurately, as long-term epidemiological studies have only been undertaken recently. The findings of the latest research studies by the National Cancer Institute were published in September of 2020 in the journal Health Physics. Speaking for herself, Genoveva says, "There were 10 of us. Now only one is surviving. She has lost everyone in her family to cancer." In a country without universal health care, debt from medical expenses has brought economic ruin to the communities near the Trinity testing site. Pino says, "All the pain and suffering we have had to endure, and not a speck of help from the government," adding, "Meanwhile, it has spent trillions of dollars on thousands of nuclear weapons." Genoveva's story is not an exceptional one. It is the story of tens of thousands of families in the United States. More than 1,000 nuclear bomb tests have been conducted in the United States between 1945 and 1992. A total of 100 above-ground tests were conducted at the Nevada test site from 1951 to 1962. The winds carried radioactive fallout for thousands of kilometers. Hundreds of millions of people living in the United States have been exposed to varying levels of radiation over the years, unknown to them. New Mexico was located downwind of the Nevada test site, and the people living there continued to be exposed to radioactivity for decades after the initial exposure during the Trinity nuclear test. People from the impacted communities founded the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium in 2005 to fight for justice for the survivors and their descendants. Tina Cordova, one of the group's co-founders, was shocked to find out that a few of the impacted states neighboring New Mexico were receiving financial compensation under the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act since 1990. However, the communities in New Mexico were left out of the act. When asked why, Cordova responds with, "It is the billion-dollar question. I think we're being left out because we're mainly Mexican Hispanics, Native Americans, and Latinos. We are minorities, and we are poor." Cordova herself is the fourth generation in her family to have cancer. She has joined with others like her to educate and organize the affected communities to fight to establish the truth. She said, "In the government's rush to bomb Japan, we were sacrificed in the process. We were enlisted in the service of our country, unknowing, unwilling, and remain uncompensated."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Thanks for joining us. Straight to our top story. Leader of the UK's opposition Labour Party, Keir Starmer, has stripped his predecessor Jeremy Corbyn of the so-called whip, meaning Corbyn won't be able to sit in Parliament as a Labour MP anymore. The move is expected to further ignite tensions within the party and undermine its ability to win elections. Corbyn was suspended at the end of last month for comments he made about an anti-Semitism report, but has since been reinstated.
Approach never.
An Equality and Human Rights Commission investigation into anti-Semitism states the UK's opposition Labour Party is responsible for unlawful acts of harassment and discrimination against British Jews. Jeremy Corbyn was critical of the figures in the report, leading to his suspension.
The numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3% of party members had a case against them.
In a new statement Tuesday, Corbyn clarified that anti-Semitism is neither exaggerated nor overstated.
The point I wish to make was that the vast majority of Labour Party members were and remain committed anti-racists, deeply opposed to anti-Semitism.
Corbyn has now been reinstated, but party leader Keir Starmer, who has made it very clear that was not his desired outcome, has refused to restore the party whip to his predecessor, calling it another painful day for the Jewish community. But some suggest the Jewish community isn't in uproar.
Why didn't he apologise? I'm asking you that straightforward question.
Because many of us know that these claims have been exaggerated. I am Jewish too. There's a lot of talk about the Jewish community just now and how offended they are and how Keir is very worried about them. There is many, many Jewish communities, and they are not all upset about Jeremy being back in the Labour Party. An awful lot of us are very happy that he's back in the party.
60,000 people signed a petition launched by Jewish Voices for Labour calling for Corbyn to be reinstated. But is this about British Jews or Israel?
Criticising Israel is a right and a human right of anyone, and indeed a duty for anyone who is caring about universal human rights because of its many war crimes. The interests really are nothing to do with protecting Jews in Britain from anti-Semitism. The interest at play is basically the Israel lobby, which demands that we shouldn't criticize Israel and we should not represent the Palestinian as human beings.
During the Labour leadership race at the beginning of this year, candidates jostled for position at the podium to promise that they would adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism and the so-called 10 pledges, both of which rule out criticism of Israel full stop and conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, showing just how much pressure British MPs feel to back Israel. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Ken Livingstone is a former London mayor joining me now to comment on this latest development. It's good to have you with us, Mayor. So Jeremy Corbyn has been reinstated, but has had the party whip withdrawn. Let's hear your thoughts.
Well, I mean, this is not really about anti-Semitism. It's been about undermining Jeremy Corbyn when he was leader, because he was the first really socialist leader we'd had for over half a century, and the establishment was terrified. He cracked down on all the tax dodging and things like that. And so all these smears and lies about anti-Semitism were whipped up. And if you remember, 4 years ago, I was suspended by the General Secretary of the Labour Party after I was accused of saying Hitler was a Zionist. I mean, and I was suspended without the General Secretary even picking up the phone to ask me if I'd said that. So I thought all along this has been about the determination of the establishment to get rid of Jeremy. And of course, when Jeremy became the leader of the Labour Party, he inherited a parliamentary Labour Party filled with MPs brought in by Tony Blair, who was very much to the right. And I just think we have to stand by Jeremy, literally, because I support Keir Starmer. I think he'll be a very good Prime Minister. I think he's got a good chance of winning the next election. But I really disagree with him on the way he's handled this, because every time we sort of concede that, yes, there is a problem with anti-Semitism, our enemies ramp it up and up. I mean, I joined the Labour Party 51 years ago. In all that time, I never once heard an anti-Semitic comment by any member.
And we heard Mr. Corbyn say earlier in our report that in actual fact, members that had cases against them as far as anti-Semitism was not 0.3%, not the exaggerated figures that have been thrown about. You made a mention of the establishment trying to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. Can the party heal itself? It seems like some will only rest if he leaves the party altogether, if he's gone.
Well, I mean, Jeremy's almost as old as I am, so frankly, we're not going to be a major factor in the next general election or anything like that. And I think Keir Starmer is just desperate to put all this anti-Semitism nonsense behind us. And he's made various concessions to our critics about all of this. But I think he wants to move on. And I think what I would say to everyone in the Labour Party, just put this behind us. Focus now on getting rid of this worst government of my lifetime, this worst Prime Minister of my lifetime. We should be out there campaigning about a better economy, creating good new jobs for ordinary people, a fairer tax system, all of those things that can really engage. And of course, if you look back at the 2017 election when Jeremy was leader, we had the biggest increase in the Labour vote for 72 years. We came within 2% of overtaking the Tories. And that was because Jeremy had a good radical agenda. That's what gets the working class out to vote.
One very brief question, Mayor. So this anti-Semitism issue continues to dog Labour. It started even before the election, continues today. Do you think the party will be able to put this behind them, like you said earlier?
Well, I think so, because, as I say, me and Jeremy are old. We're basically retired. We've had to put up with all these smears. But the reality is that any serious investigation in the Labour Party will just come up, as Jeremy said, with 0.3%. And under Jeremy's leadership, he got a good new General Secretary, and something like 300 Labour Party members were expelled for having tweeted something anti-Semitic. That's out of our 500,000 members.
Mm. All right. Thank you very much, Ken Livingstone, former London mayor, speaking with us. Appreciate it. Let's have a look at some other news. Deep into the second wave of the coronavirus outbreak, European nations are tightening restrictions and social distancing measures to curb the spread of the virus. The government in Greece closed primary schools across the country for 2 weeks yesterday. In Austria, Chancellor Sebastian Kurz says his country will be enforcing stricter restrictions, such as closing non-essential stores and switching schools to online teaching. As the world continues to struggle against economically suffocating restrictions, the race for a COVID-19 vaccine is on. Scientific journal Lancet has published a study saying a vaccine developed in China has shown success in mid-stage trials. The announcement comes after pharmaceutical companies in the U.S., Germany, and Russia released data suggesting more than 90% efficacy after trials with tens of thousands of people. Well, Dr. Bob Gill joins me now for more details on that story. It's good to have you with us, Doctor. So with news of strides made in various vaccines, could this be the silver bullet we've been waiting for and perhaps a way out of the pandemic?
Hello, yes, thank you for having me on. It's encouraging news to hear about the vaccines that are being developed, but we shouldn't forget the basic important messages in terms of controlling the spread, which is good hygiene and good ventilation and avoiding large crowds. So it gives us an additional tool in the fight, and the preliminary news on the vaccines is encouraging.
Exactly, and that's what the Prime Minister has been telling people as well, so have all the other leaders around the world. There is a lot of skepticism and conspiracy theories about vaccines, people saying they're going to shoot some kind of a microchip into us. Do you think we can get past that?
These sort of doubts cast on the vaccines are coming from a place of mistrust. There's growing mistrust in terms of what the public think of government, and it's not helped by the catastrophic handling in this country and in America of the pandemic so far. So we need reliable sources of information. We need to speak to the experts in the field to rebuild that trust, because it's only when the trust breaks down and communication is poor that these theories can take hold.
And we obviously need transparency over how the vaccines have been developed, when they are developed. Again, revelations, you spoke of the catastrophic way it's been handled here in the UK and in the US. Revelations of sleaze and extortion of government spending throughout the pandemic in this country have shocked our audiences. Are there any retrospective procedures to tackle this trend?
Well, we need full disclosure. The government have been very secretive about the contracts they've handed out. They've squandered billions. More and more information is trickling out. There are groups like the Good Law Project and other individuals who are pursuing the government in the courts to try and get all this information into the public domain. But what we do know is released emails from the Cabinet Office show there were VIP lists where people connected to the Tory party, donors and other individuals, were given lucrative contracts without public tendering and without open disclosure. So that needs to be investigated. I think there's a case for increasing the chances of governments and its officials being prosecuted for corruption in such circumstances. This is what's going on here. People are profiteering from the pandemic, squandering money. Meanwhile, the numbers, you know, being killed by the virus and being affected is sky high in this country. It's an absolute disgrace.
Right, profiteering from the pandemic. That's quotable. Dr. Bob Gill, thank you for coming on. All right, let's move on. Ongoing anti-government protests in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, to renew demands for fresh elections in the wake of last month's disputed parliamentary polls. The protesters say the October 31st election that saw the ruling Georgian Dream Party win the majority of the votes was fraudulent. A second round of elections is scheduled for this weekend. The demonstrations come as U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo holds talks with Georgian politicians and church leaders on his 10-day tour of the region. Pompeo's next stop will be Israel, where he'll be visiting illegal Israeli settlements inside the West Bank. A potential diplomatic fallout in the Balkans after Bulgaria blocked official EU accession talks for neighboring North Macedonia. Official talks were expected to begin in December. In a video meeting of European ministers, Germany's European Affairs Minister, Michael Roth, said it was up to both countries to resolve their disputes. Foreign Minister Ekaterina Zaharieva said Bulgaria could not support negotiations between the 27-member bloc and North Macedonia over historical disputes, but remained open for talks. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has been praised by some as a better alternative to Donald Trump when it comes to improving the lives of Palestinians. But many have been questioning Biden's credentials and whether or not he'll be any different. Robert N. Lakesh has this.
Joe Biden, the so-called lesser of two evils, now looks like he will become the new president of the United States come January. So anticipating his first moves on foreign policy whilst in office, let's take a look at how Joe Biden's presidency could shape the future of Palestine-Israel and see whether he truly constitutes the title a lesser of two evils when it comes to Israel-Palestine. To begin with, Joe Biden is undoubtedly pro-Israel. This is not a disputable fact.
My father pointed out to me I did not need to be a Jew to be a Zionist, for I am.
Also, one of Biden's largest campaign financiers was a guy called Haim Saban, a man who, in his own words, is a one-issue guy, that issue being Israel. But despite this, many on the left see Biden as being better for the Palestinian people than Trump, as he supports the notion of a two-state solution. So in order to look at whether this is even possible for Biden to achieve at this point and what he'd simply have to just reverse to even get reasonable talks going on a two-state solution, let us imagine for a moment that Joe Biden does want to achieve a two-state solution, putting behind us Biden's support for every war the U.S. has engaged in during his time as an elected official, including the Iraq War. First of all, if you even speak of achieving a two-state solution, you need to consider the final status issues and find a just solution for them. They are namely the issue of Jerusalem al-Quds, settlements, borders, and the Palestinian refugee issue. On the issue of Jerusalem al-Quds, Trump officially announced it as the undivided capital of Israel and moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to al-Quds. Joe Biden is on the record stating that he would not reverse this recognition and would not move the U.S. embassy back to Tel Aviv. Now, if you are not going to allow for a Palestinian capital to be in East Jerusalem al-Quds, then automatically you will get nowhere with these negotiations. Because on this point, there is nothing to discuss and no Palestinian leadership is going to accept a capital anywhere else. On the issue of settlements, the official Democratic Party position is that they call for a halt to their expansion. However, no administration has ever achieved this, and Joe Biden has stated that he would not even condition the billions in U.S. aid to Israel in order to get them to stop. Under Trump, settlement expansion has gone up over 300%, and currently around 750,000 illegal racial colonists live in occupied territories. Without stopping settlements, how could you even begin to solve the issue? On the issue of borders, Joe Biden would have to get rid of Israel's illegally built apartheid wall, re-divert water supplies which the Israelis steal from underneath Palestinian lands, and ensure Israel leave the land it illegally occupies. But if Biden, as he has stated before, believes that these illegal moves are justified for the safety of the white European supremacist regime, there is little chance of any progress there. Then comes the Palestinian refugee issue, which under international law would mean allowing millions of Palestinians to return or have access to their homelands. Yet Biden has been opposed to this. Under Donald Trump, in an attempt to destroy the Palestinian refugees and their rights, the U.S. withdrew funds from UNRWA, the UN agency set up for Palestinian refugees. The first move in office would have to be to fund this once again. If Biden fails to do so again, there can be no hope of even entering into peace talks, when refugees are literally starving as a result of this move. Ultimately, the unelected, unrepresentative Palestinian Authority, or PA, has said that they will enter back into dialogue with the U.S. under Joe Biden and will again begin to serve Israel's occupation forces by selling out its own people once again. To this, Kamala Harris had said she'd invite the PA back to Washington, from which they were kicked out under Donald Trump. But ultimately, this has little to do with Biden and Harris and more to do with a PA which has yet again confirmed its commitment to serving Israel and the U.S. for money. It also speaks volumes about how quickly the PA elites are willing to sell out their own cause and people for their positions, making them complete hypocrites when they criticize the likes of the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudanese regimes for normalizing. On top of all of this, the Israeli military is now pushing Netanyahu to annex the West Bank before the departure of Trump from the White House. If this actually ends up going ahead, then this, yet again, is something which would require much more pressure than Biden is willing to place on Israel to reverse it. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are pro-Israel to the core and won't even commit to abiding by international law when it comes to the rights of Palestinians. When it comes to helping the Palestinian people, the U.S. clearly has no desire, and it is sad to see that many are yet again hoping for the Democrats to act. Ultimately, you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig.
In this segment, another instance of senseless and tragic violence at the hands of U.S. police. A November 13 shooting in Coco, a neighborhood of Brevard County, Florida. The victims, a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old. For more, let's cross over to Richard Sudan. Richard, fill us in.
Yeah, as you said, Saeed, 16-year-old Anthony Crooms and 18-year-old Sincere Pierce were shot to death by one police officer.
Richard, when I looked at that video, it starts a little earlier when they're following the car with the kids inside it, but then it's all silent up to a point where they start, you know, coming out of their cars and pointing their guns at them and telling them to stop.
Exactly. A number of questions. Why shoot to kill? Why not pursue these boys in a car? Why be so trigger happy? There are a number of questions here. Why shoot to kill is the main one. And frankly, Saeed, there are plenty of videos of white people in the United States wielding guns and knives in a very threatening, obvious manner of the police, and they simply don't get shot in this manner. But of course, you know, we've learned from the case of Breonna Taylor, for example, that black people can actually be unarmed and in their sleep and be killed by the police in their own homes. So maybe this doesn't really come as too much of a surprise. Also not surprising is the officer hasn't been named. He's been placed on administrative leave. And actually, there's been no explanation from the police to the families, much less an apology. I just want to go to a couple of reactions, if I may. The first one from Justice on Twitter, who says, "Rest in peace, Sincere Pierce and AJ Crooms." And Tariq Nasheed says, "Another cowardly ambush killing by a race soldier in Florida. This race soldier, whose identity is being protected, killed two black teens at the same time. They are ramping up the anti-black war out here in the streets. Countering these race soldiers should be our only priority." So some strong reactions on there as this story is gaining momentum, Saeed.
All right, let's move on to your second story, Richard. Someone else has dared contradict Donald Trump and lost his job.
Again, another day, another firing by Donald Trump. So Trump has fired Chris Krebs, the U.S. Director of Cybersecurity at Homeland Security. And in a nutshell, what's happened here is Chris Krebs has made a number of statements basically saying that there is or was no electoral fraud regarding the recent U.S. election. And of course, this flies in the face of what Donald Trump has been saying all over Twitter pretty much every day, insisting that there's voter election fraud, insisting that he won the election, etc., etc., to the point that Twitter has actually censored or provided warnings, you know, over a number of his tweets. But this really is kind of the hallmarks and the behavior of an erratic president, increasingly erratic, who simply cannot get a firm grip on reality. Of course, you know, we've seen in recent days Trump basically saber-rattling and potentially threatening Iran. So I think this does beg the question, really, does Donald Trump present, you know, more of a threat in his final days in office than he has in the first four? Because he seems intent on really throwing all of his political toys out of the pram. Chris Krebs is literally, you know, the most recent victim. It's almost like watching Trump in his reality TV series. You're fired.
Right, and we're also hearing that he isn't very happy with the CIA director that he himself appointed. We'll see how that goes. Bring us some online reaction to this story, Richard.
Sure, I'd like to go first to a tweet from LJ, who says, "And then Trump fired you, Chris Krebs, via tweet when you told the truth and your team protected our 2020 presidential election, because that's what a totally unqualified, whiny brat president of the United States does when the facts and the votes say he lost the election. Joe Biden, let's bring Chris Krebs back in, please." And Mum tweeted, "Donald Trump fired someone yet again via a tweet. Chris Krebs was man enough to tell the truth, knowing it would enrage Trump and jeopardize his job. Trump wasn't even man enough to fire Chris Krebs in person. Hashtag raging bully. Hashtag off with their heads." Some powerful reactions there that we're seeing online, Saeed.
Powerful indeed. Richard Sedan with those stories and tweets. Richard, thank you. And thank you for keeping us company. Take care.